This week on Making Contact.
Much before anyone else is asked to shut up, women are asked to shut up. And that happens all the time.
As a journalist, I have seen the many faces of desperation in my country. Many of my colleagues have died in the line of duty.
Women are gaining influence as leaders throughout the world, fighting for peace, justice, the environment, and civil society. In this program, we profile three courageous women writer activists. Ritu Menon is the leading feminist publisher in India. Maria Cristina Caballero is a Colombian journalist whose writings are helping to put peace on the negotiating table in Colombia. And Aseli Angel Ajani is an African-American writer whose work on Colombia is raising awareness about the international peace community movement. I'm Sandina Robbins, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program creating connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. This program is a special collaboration with the Women Rising Radio Project. Indian author Ritu Menon first understood the power of the written word while helping to publish Kate Millett's pioneering book, Sexual Politics, in the early years of the U.S. women's movement. Since that time, Ritu's been publishing in South Asia for more than 20 years and spearheading India's foremost feminist press called Kali for Women.
All the years that I was growing up, my grandmother was very much a part of our life, of our family life. And she would say to me always, you must work. So I said, what do you mean by that? She said, well, I don't know, maybe be a journalist. She was married at 12 and she was illiterate, but one of the wisest women I've known and extremely intelligent. So she said to me, she said, well, you know, look at me. I can't read the newspapers. I can't talk to you in English. So you be sure and continue to study, and then don't not work. So I said, what difference does it make whether I work or I don't? She said, no, you must keep your destiny in your hands. Don't let anyone else be responsible for your self-realization. You be responsible for it. So I laughed. I mean, I laughed then because I thought, oh, well, you know, she's just being fanciful and kind. But she wasn't. She was dead serious. And I realize now exactly how serious she was and what it meant. And now I think, my goodness, yes, she was absolutely right. There's no way that I could have not, in some way or other, tried to shape my destiny. And I think that the work with women's writing, that is, the possibility of expressing yourself, the possibility of having the power of voice, the possibility of articulation is very important. People ask us why we publish only on women, and we say, well, it's half the world. And then they say, so do you then focus on women's issues? And we say, well, every issue is a women's issue. So we actually publish on everything from peace and militarization to reproductive health and education and literacy and violence and, well, you know, all of the issues that we're familiar with, but of course from a feminist perspective. And I've also been working quite a lot on issues of censorship, of gender-based censorship, or shall we say the gendered nature of censorship. And that's actually not formal censorship as it's generally understood, which is banning and proscribing and so on, but informal censorship, of which there's a whole array. What we did in India was to do a series of workshops with about 200 writers on what they thought of as censorship. And of course, all of them said, well, no, there's no censorship in India because, yes, formally there's very little. Very few pieces of writing will be banned or proscribed. But when we started exploring the question and looking at the circumstances in which women write, as well as the circumstances in which they are read and written about, then, well, it was a completely different scene. And it was extraordinary how many women said to us that they wouldn't be able to write their autobiographies because they wouldn't be able to tell the truth. And they wouldn't be able to tell the truth because of enormous familial pressure, usually from fathers, husbands, even sons, brothers, of course. Husbands, sons, fathers being the three most critical. So what is it that they wouldn't be allowed to write about? Well, it was funny, but it was quite often violence. There is a writer, a young woman, who writes in Tamil, which is one of the South Indian languages. And she told us about how after her divorce from her husband, she wrote a poem about their divorce. And she's a pretty well-known writer in the sense that her poetry gets read quite widely. And when it was published and read, her ex-husband was so enraged that he broke her right wrist so that she wouldn't write anymore. Of course, she continued to write. But what I mean to say is that the physical violence can take such extreme forms. It doesn't always take such extreme forms because, as we know very well from all of the work that women have been doing on violence, it's either actual violence or the threat of violence that are usually enough. The issue of preemptive censorship, let's say, is very clear. In the case of Taslima Nasreen's autobiography, Volume 2 of which was banned by the West Bengal government. And it's also unusual because, in fact, governments in India very seldom ban. It's not something that's done commonly. So the first surprising thing is that she was banned. And the second surprising thing is that she was banned by a state government that has actually always sympathized with her. So for this government to have done it is extremely reprehensible. And it's also very alarming because it's a Marxist government. We know through forms of political censorship that women in the party cannot challenge the party, nor can they speak about violence in the party, nor can they speak about male chauvinism in the party. So, you know, you can be progressive in your politics and quite reactionary when it comes to gender relations. And the Marxists are no strangers to that.
From Ritu Menon's perspective, few, if any, political ideologies, governments, or movements adequately address the global problems that women face solely because they are women.
It's about women's equality. It's about empowerment. It's about addressing the subordination of women, the oppression, their oppression. It's about poverty, it's about health, it's about violence, it's about all of these things. So the struggle is still on. It's nowhere near being won. And if we don't continue, or if we don't continue to A, recognize the importance of protest, and B, recognize the importance of analysis, then we're not about to change anything. So I think what keeps me going is the hope that by doing that, we can make a difference collectively.
We'll hear more from Women Rising in a few moments. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for a cassette or CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. Colombian journalist Maria Cristina Caballero published her first series of articles in the newspaper El Tiempo at age 16. She protested the lack of books for school children and created a campaign to distribute millions of books throughout Colombia. By exposing corruption in the Colombian government, she has earned the respect of many and the hatred of some. Recently, Maria Cristina Caballero received the International Press Freedom Award from the Committee to Protect Journalists for her groundbreaking work on Colombia's ongoing brutal war.
I was a Nieman Fellow at Harvard in 1997. Before I came, I was mainly focused in all these social issues and corruption cases. I have interviewed some people about the violence, but when I was a Nieman in 1997, I organized a conference on Colombia and violence, and it was Law and Democracy in Colombia, Alternatives to Violence. The first day I returned to Colombia, I began listening about an awful massacre. It was a huge coincidence, the same day that I arrived to Colombia, in Mapiripan, in the south of Colombia. People were cut in pieces for 5 days. And listening to the radio, the first reports in the radio, Colombian radio, were talking about pieces of bodies in the rivers. And the day that I went to say hello to the magazine that I was working for at that time, I said, who is going to investigate this? What is going on in Mapiripan in the south of Colombia? No one wanted to go. Then I said, I will go. Then the first day I went back to Colombia, I went to Mapiripan. And the massacre was awful. People were totally traumatized there. As I mentioned, during 5 days, people were ordered to be in line in front of the slaughterhouse of this little town. And one by one were cut in pieces in the slaughterhouse, torturing them to get information about the guerrilla. This was the first big massacre from the paramilitaries, the right-wing faction in Colombia that combat illegally the guerrillas. This massacre, I investigated this massacre for a long time, and many others that continue after this one. And all my investigation showed that the person that was ordering these massacres in the south of Colombia was Carlos Castaño. Then I said, I have to talk with him. I have to know what is in his mind. Is he crazy? What is his goal? How can he explain this suffering? What will he say about why is he doing this? Through many, many contacts for more than 6 months, I sent letters and sent messages. Finally, in December of 1997, I received a message that he was going to receive me. People at the magazine told me, "My Cristina, are you crazy? How are you going to this region? It's the worst human rights abuser in the Colombian history. Look how he's killing people. He will kill you. You have been exposing all his operations in the south of Colombia. And the links in some cases, not in all the cases, with some military officials for omission or direct involvement. He obviously is planning to kill you." And I say, I have insisted for 6 months, more than 6 months, to get an interview with him. I have to go.
Si no creyera en la locura de la garganta del sinsonte.
Traveling alone for many hours into the North Colombian jungle, Maria Cristina put her life into the hands of Colombia's most feared right-wing paramilitary leader.
After changing cars more than 10 times, it was like really a movie. We cross small rivers that they put down trunks of the trees, and immediately we passed, they removed them. Then the trace was totally erased. Then after many, many, many hours, we got to a place, and then we have to ride horses. And it was a very long adventure. And finally, we found Carlos Castaño surrounded by 300 men, his personal guard, in a very, very far away region in a mountain of Colombia, in the north of Colombia. And he shake my hand and say, "Welcome, I am Carlos Castaño." I say, "I finally meet you." And we began talking immediately. We talked for more than 5 hours. It was a very, very intense conversation. And he, at some point, to my surprise, even cried, saying that it was not what he wanted to do, that if he stopped killing people, he and his people would be immediately killed. And I said, would you be willing to talk about a peace process? Because for more than 30 years, he had never been involved in a peace process. Would you be willing to meet with the guerrilla leaders? Would you be willing to talk about this as openly as you have been talking with me? Weeks later, I received an emissary from him with the first peace proposals from his movement. That was the origin of Peace on the Table, because as soon as I received the peace proposal from Carlos Castaño, I said, this is more than news. No, this can mean lives for many.
Peace on the Table was a series of articles in the Colombian press exploring the avenues towards settling 50 years of civil war. Maria Cristina has also interviewed the leader of the left-wing guerrillas and leaders of other factions and published peace proposals from all of them. She still hopes that Peace on the Table will bring reconciliation and stop the senseless killings in Colombia. When she accepted the International Press Freedom Award from the Committee to Protect Journalists, Maria Cristina spoke of her profound concern for the Colombian people.
In July of 1997, I covered a terrible massacre in the town of Mapiripan. Right-wing paramilitaries cut many of the inhabitants into pieces during 5 days. As I was leaving, a very old man without shoes ran to me and said, "Wait, wait." He told me, "All of my sons are dead. 3 of them joined the guerrillas, and 2 joined the paramilitaries. Perhaps they kill each other." With tears in his eyes, he said, "Please, help us. Guerrillas and paramilitaries are killing all our children, all our future. You that have had the opportunity to study, help us. Please help us." I could only say, "I will do my best." I feel that my role in Colombia is to give voice to the voiceless. The real heroes, the ones I would like to honor, are those like that old man who cling to hope in the midst of desperation.
Si no creyera en mi camino, si no creyera en mi sonido, si no creyera en mi silencio, ay, qué cosa fuera la masa sin cantera, un amasijo hecho de cuerdas y tendones, un revoltijo de carne con madera.
The war in Colombia is also written into the destiny of anthropologist and writer Aseli Angel Ajani, who has lived and worked with Colombia's peace communities. Aseli sees herself as part of the worldwide African diaspora, which she has studied and chronicled. Her background includes African, Irish, Dutch, Native American, and Cuban heritage, and her first language was Spanish.
Growing up and spending time in California, we were always taught that speaking Spanish was bad. I mean, it was a language of mostly Mexican immigrants, and there weren't any other sort of Latinos really in my area, so there weren't other Cubans. And there was such a sort of sharp racial divide in my school that you sort of had to pick one side or the other. And for me, it was always just easier to see myself as being Black or African American, and therefore sort of having to make sure that I didn't speak with an accent or I didn't speak Spanish. And I have always struggled, even with this idea of me being a writer, I've always struggled with this, the question of language and what's mine. I mean, my emotional life is completely lived in Spanish. So even though I don't speak Spanish near as well as I speak English, that emotional part of my life I can't access through English. So all of my love songs and all of the, when I want to craft something in my mind about how I'm feeling, it's usually in Spanish.
Aseli was drawn to Colombia when she joined the International Peace Community Movement. This worldwide network links up with the United Nations High Commission on Refugees to give support to civilians who are caught in armed conflict. It helps them to remain neutral or moves them to more secure areas of their countries. Colombia's peace communities provide vital safe havens for thousands of internal refugees.
I was asked by a good friend of mine who lives and works in Colombia now to come with her to this town of Apartadó to do some work around the Afro-Colombian peace communities. And the peace communities in this area, in the Urabá Chocó area, are mostly Afro-Colombian, mestizo, and indigenous people. So they're completely mixed communities. And it's really amazing in terms of the communal project there. I mean, Colombia, like the U.S., is also a sort of equally racially divided country. And here we have these people who live along the river in this particular area where over 85% of the population they're illiterate and completely underfunded and disenfranchised. So you have this project, this community project of these peace communities, and there are over 64 of them. But I have to say, the first time I went to the peace communities, it was sort of me stumbling into something. I'm sadly or happily, depending on how you want to look at it, an anthropologist, technically. I mean, I went to school, went to graduate school, received a PhD, and was told that you write a particular way about particular incidences in the world. And so going to Colombia was more out of a sort of intellectual or academic project. I had no idea that this would be the place that finally sort of cracked open this true desire that was within me, which was to actually write and to, again, tap into that other side of myself, that other emotional side of me that lives in Spanish in terms of language. Well, I've always wanted to write. Always, 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 always. That's all I've ever wanted to do is write, from novels to poetry, you know, critical essays, whatever. I just love writing, as vexing as it is. It wasn't until I went to Colombia and was living in this community, the community of Costa de Oro, which is an amazing community. It is a conglomeration of over five communities living there, five peace communities, living in that environment and recognizing, I mean, we were surrounded by the paramilitaries and we were surrounded by conflict. And there was a way that life still happened, and life still happened in this very beautiful way. And in terms of just the colors, I mean, the greens and the blues and the yellows and the reds and then the sounds. I mean, there are the night sounds of conflict and of people crying. And then there are the day sounds of children sort of having that momentary ability to sort of forget about what's happening around them, listening to their laughter and their playing and they're enjoying each other's company and running around, and then people talking. I mean, and that's the other thing too. I mean, in the evening, villagers would from other peace communities or from other communities would come through Costa de Oro and tell us what was happening in the surrounding parts. And so people then spoke in whispers. And so I just felt really moved by this. And never have I ever felt more moved in my life by people, by a political project for peace. And when I came back to the U.S., and I didn't want to come back, I wanted to stay, because everything that I had been sort of struggling around in terms of political action my entire life, from the time I was 9 until, you know, 30-something, it was all there. It was all in the peace community. It was all there, everything. It was almost as if my life sort of finally made sense to me. Speaking it, I can't put it into words right now, but it was that moment, because of all the things that I saw and I felt and witnessed, that was what sort of inspired me and moved me and sort of created this thing within me that said, I have to write about this. If I don't write about anything else, this is the thing that I need to write about. I would like it to be more novel than sort of creative nonfiction, and a political novel, and really sort of trying to encompass all of the beauty of that place that I don't think that kind of straight up facts kind of give you. And so that's what I'm sort of toying with, to be honest.
Asaleh Angel Ajani's creative nonfiction essay, We Survived, is her first attempt to write about her peace community experiences. It has won prizes and is currently a featured work at Women's World, the global organization formed by writer Meredith Tax to promote women writers. Asaleh shares a part of that essay.
Twilight finally managed to break through Knight's brutal exchange between the FARC and the Colombian military. In Andalusia, a small river community along the Cuenca off the Rio Trato, we rattle our way through our morning rituals, bodies still sleeping, minds alert, our ears filtering out the sounds of the jungle from man-made chaos. Weeks of nocturnal combat piled on months of the presence of armed actors, joined with the years of threats, displacement, forced recruitment, and death, and more death renders this a war zone. But this plot of land, this carved-out community on top of a hill surrounded by sugarcane, is more than just the space between warring armies. In the soil lives memory's ghosts. First words were spoken here. The trees contain the maps to dreams carefully crafted in the once quiet evenings. On the walls, sounds of laughter and first love are recorded.
Media vuelta y la compañera forma una rueda para seguir. Viene el gaucho, le hace un...
That's it for this Women's Desk edition of Making Contact. These profiles of international changemakers were co-produced with Lynn Feinerman's Women Rising radio series, a project of Crown Safira Productions. Special thanks to Pauline Bartolone for technical direction and production assistance. Music by Mercedes Sosa, Celia Cruz, and Shubha Mudgal. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. You can learn more about these courageous women at radioproject.org. For a cassette or CD copy of this program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. Making Contact is an independent production funded primarily by individual contributors. We're committed to providing a forum for voices and opinions not often heard in the mass media. If you'd like to support our work, or if you have suggestions for future programs, we'd love to hear from you. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Amy Palmerlow, production director, Justin Beck, associate producer, Marguerite Judson, development director, Rishen McKee, office manager, Dory Taylor, distribution and outreach, Peggy Law, founding director, Norman Solomon, senior advisor, David Barsamian, national advisor, and I'm your host, Sandina Robbins.